Passage 38.
Appreciation of sculpture depends upon the ability to respond to form in three dimensions. That is perhaps why sculpture has been described as the most difficult of all arts. Certainly, it is more difficult than the arts which involve appreciation of flat forms, shape in only two dimensions. Many more people are form blind than color blind. The child learning to see first distinguishes only two-dimensional shape. It cannot judge distances, depths. Later, for its personal safety and practical needs, it has to develop, partly by means of touch, the ability to judge roughly three-dimensional distances. But having satisfied the requirement of practical necessity, most people go no further. Though they may attain considerable accuracy in the perception of flat form, they do not make the further intellectual and emotional effort needed to comprehend form in its full spatial existence. This is what the sculptor must do. He must strive continually to think of and use form in its full spatial completeness. He gets the solid shape, as it were, inside his head. He thinks of it, whatever its size, as if he were holding it completely enclosed in the hollow of his hand. He mentally visualizes a complex form from all around itself. He knows when he looks at one side what the other side is like. He identifies himself with its center of gravity, its mass, its weight. He realizes its volume as the space that the shape displaces in the air. And the sensitive observer of sculpture must also learn to feel shape simply as shape, not as description or reminiscence. He must, for example, perceive an egg as a simple, single, solid shape, quite apart from its significance as food, or from the literary idea that it will become a bird. And so with solids such as a shell, a nut, a plum, a pear, a tadpole, a mushroom, a mountain peak, a kidney, a carrot, a tree trunk, a bird, a bud, a lark, a ladybird, a bulrush, a bone. From these, he can go on to appreciate more complex forms or combinations of several forms. Henry Moore, The Sculptor Speaks, from The Listener. Passage 39.
In his own lifetime, Galileo was the center of violent controversy. The scientific dust has long since settled, and today we can see even his famous clash with the Inquisition in something like its proper perspective. But in contrast, it's only in modern times that Galileo has become a problem child for historians in science. The old view of Galileo was delightfully uncomplicated. He was, above all, a man who experimented, who despised the prejudices and book learning of the Aristotelians, who put his questions to nature instead of to the ancients, and who drew his conclusions fearlessly. He had been the first to turn a telescope to the sky, and he had seen there evidence enough to overthrow Aristotle and Ptolemy together. He was the man who climbed the Leaning Tower of Pisa and dropped various weights from the top, who rolled balls down inclined planes, and then generalized the results of his many experiments into the famous law of free fall. But a closer study of the evidence, supported by a deeper sense of the period, and particularly by a new consciousness of the philosophical undercurrents in the scientific revolution, has profoundly modified this view of Galileo. Today, although the old Galileo lives on in many popular writings among historians of science, a new and more sophisticated picture has emerged. At the same time, our sympathy for Galileo's opponents has grown somewhat. His telescopic observations are justly immortal. They aroused great interest at the time. They had important theoretical consequences, and they provided a striking demonstration of the potentialities hidden in instruments and apparatus. But can we blame those who looked and failed to see what Galileo saw, if we remember that to use a telescope at the limit of its powers calls for long experience and intimate familiarity with one's instrument? Was the philosopher who refused to look through Galileo's telescope more culpable than those who alleged that the spiral nebulae observed with Lord Rosse's great telescope in the 1840s were scratches left by the grinder? We can perhaps forgive those who said that the moons of Jupiter were produced by Galileo's spyglass, if we recall that in his day, as for centuries before, curved glass was the popular contrivance for producing not truth but illusion, untruth, and if a single curved glass would distort nature, how much more would a pair of them? Michael Hoskin, Galileo Reborn, from The Listener. Passage 40.
Populations increase and decrease relatively, not only to one another, but also to natural resources. In most parts of the world, the relation between population and resources is already unfavorable, and will probably become even more unfavorable in the future. This growing poverty in the midst of growing poverty constitutes a permanent menace to peace, and not only to peace, but also to democratic institutions and personal liberty. For overpopulation is not compatible with freedom. An unfavorable relationship between numbers and resources tends to make the earning of a living almost intolerably difficult. Labor is more abundant than goods, and the individual is compelled to work long hours for little pay. No surplus of accumulated purchasing power stands between him and the tyrannies of unfriendly nature or of the equally unfriendly wielders of political and economic power. Democracy is, among other things, the ability to say no to the boss. But a man cannot say no to the boss unless he is sure of being able to eat when the boss's favor has been withdrawn. And he cannot be certain of his next meal unless he owns the means of producing enough wealth for his family to live on, or has been able to accumulate a surplus out of past wages, or has a chance of moving to virgin territories where he can make a fresh start. In an overcrowded country, very few people own enough to make them financially independent. Very few are in a position to accumulate purchasing power, and there is no free land. Moreover, in any country where population presses hard upon natural resources, the general economic situation is apt to be so precarious that government control of capital and labor, production and consumption, becomes inevitable. It is no accident that the 20th century should be the century of highly centralized governments and totalitarian dictatorships. It had to be so for the simple reason that the 20th century is the century of planetary overcrowding. Aldous Huxley, Themes and Variations. Unit 5, Passage 41.
Education is one of the key words of our time. A man without an education, many of us believe, is an unfortunate victim of adverse circumstances, deprived of one of the greatest 20th century opportunities. Convinced of the importance of education, modern states invest in institutions of learning to get back interest in the form of a large group of enlightened young men and women who are potential leaders. Education, with its cycles of instruction so carefully worked out, punctuated by textbooks, those purchasable wells of wisdom, what would civilization be like without its benefits? So much is certain, that we would have doctors and preachers, lawyers and defendants, marriages and births, but our spiritual outlook would be different. We would lay stress on facts and figures, and more on a good memory, on applied psychology, and on the capacity of a man to get along with his fellow citizens. If our educational system were fashioned after its bookless past, we would have the most democratic form of college imaginable. Among the people whom we like to call savages, all knowledge inherited by tradition is shared by all. It is taught to every member of the tribe, so that in this respect everybody is equally equipped for life. It is the ideal condition of the equal start, which only our most progressive forms of modern education try to regain. In primitive cultures, the obligation to seek and to receive the traditional instruction is binding to all. There are no illiterates, if the term can be applied to peoples without a script. While our own compulsory school attendance became law in Germany in 1642, in France in 1806, and in England in 1876, and is still non-existent in a number of civilized nations, this shows how long it was before we deemed it necessary to make sure that all our children could share in the knowledge accumulated by the happy few during the past centuries. There is none of the hurry which in our society often hampers the full development of a growing personality. There, a child grows up under the ever-present attention of his parents. Therefore, the jungles and the savannas know of no juvenile delinquency. No necessity of making a living away from home results in neglect of children, and no father is confronted with his inability to buy an education for his child. Julius E. Lipps, The Origin of Things. Passage 42.
Parents are often upset when their children praise the home of their friends and regard it as a slur on their own cooking or cleaning or furniture, and often are foolish enough to let the adolescents see that they are annoyed. They may even accuse them of disloyalty or make some spiteful remark about the friend's parents. Such a loss of dignity and descent into childish behavior on the part of the adults deeply shocks the adolescents and makes them resolve that in future they will not talk to their parents about the places or people they visit. Before very long, the parents will be complaining that the child is so secretive and never tells them anything, but they seldom realize that they have brought this on themselves. Disillusionment with the parents, however good and adequate they may be, both as parents and as individuals, is to some degree inevitable. Most children have such a high ideal of their parents, unless the parents themselves have been unsatisfactory, that it can hardly hope to stand up to a realistic evaluation. Parents will be greatly surprised and deeply touched if they realize how much belief their children usually have in their character and infallibility, and how much this faith means to a child. If parents were prepared for this adolescent reaction and realized that it was a sign that the child was growing up and developing valuable powers of observation and independent judgment, they would not be so hurt, and therefore would not drive the child into opposition by resenting and resisting it. The adolescent, with his passion for sincerity, always respects a parent who admits that he is wrong or ignorant, or even that he has been unfair or unjust. What the child cannot forgive is the parent's refusal to admit these charges if the child knows them to be true. Victorian parents believed that they kept their dignity by retreating behind an unreasoning authoritarian attitude. In fact, they did nothing of the kind, but children were then too cowed to let them know how they really felt. Today we tend to go to the other extreme, but on the whole this is a healthier attitude, both for the child and the parent. It is always wiser and safer to face up to reality, however painful it may be at the moment. Doris Odlum, Journey Through Adolescence. Passage 43.
Faith in controlled nuclear fission is now being shown by the construction of atomic power stations. In Britain, Calder Hall, on the coast of Cumberland, first made its contribution to the national electricity grid in 1957. Subsequently, a chain of nuclear power stations was planned. Of necessity, they are sited near the coasts or tidal water, because of the need of much water for cooling and a certain discharge of possible radioactive effluent. Atomic power is associated in the public mind with the destructive force of atom bombs, and partly for this reason, though it is claimed that there is no danger to be associated with atomic power stations, they are being sited away from populous centres. The present position is that the three main sources of power are coal, oil and water power. We sometimes refer to electricity, gas, or petrol as if they were the actual sources of power, forgetting that electricity must be generated by the consumption of coal or oil or by the utilization of water power, whilst coke, gas, and petrol are examples of secondary fuels by which coal and oil may be more effectively used. Where alternative sources of power are available, there are some marked contrasts in handling. The bulk and weight of coal required in the majority of manufacturing industries is large in comparison with the bulk and the weight of other raw materials. This is not always true, as with the manufacture of pig iron and steel from low-grade iron ores, but it did lead to the concentration of industrial developments on the coal fields, a phenomenon well seen in such countries as Britain, where the Industrial Revolution came before the days of oil or electricity. Coal, being a solid, must be distributed mainly by rail or water. By way of contrast, oil can be transported large distances by pipeline, but overseas movement has involved building of a large numbers of tankers, including now some of the largest vessels afloat. Unless suitable on other grounds, oil fields have not become industrial regions. On the contrary, the oil industry is marked by a certain amount of smell and an element of danger, hence the siting of refineries at a distance from population centres. It is not always realised that the owners of pipelines can handle the oil of different customers, sending it through at different periods. Natural gas can also be transported large distances by pipe. Early in 1959, Britain received the first ship cargo of natural gas, liquefied for the purpose of transport. L. Dudley Stamp, Our Developing World. Passage 44.
If a nation is essentially disunited, it is left to the government to hold it together. This increases the expense of government and reduces, correspondingly, the amount of economic resources that could be used for developing the country. And it should not be forgotten how small those resources are in a poor and backward country. Where the cost of government is high, resources for development are correspondingly low. This may be illustrated by comparing the position of a nation with that of a private business enterprise. An enterprise has to incur certain costs and expenses in order to stay in business. For our purposes, we are concerned only with one kind of cost, the cost of managing and administering the business. Such administrative overhead in a business is analogous to the cost of government in a nation. The administrative overhead of a business is low to the extent that everyone working in the business can be trusted to behave in a way that best promotes the interest of the firm. If they can each be trusted to take such responsibilities and to exercise such initiative as falls within their sphere, then administrative overhead will be low. It will be low because it will be necessary to have only one man looking after each job, without having another man to check upon what he is doing, keep him in line, and report on him to someone else. But if no one can be trusted to act in a loyal and responsible manner towards his job, then the business will require armies of administrators, checkers, and foremen, and administrative overhead will rise correspondingly. As administrative overhead rises, so the earnings of the business, after meeting the expense of administration, will fall, and the business will have less money to distribute as dividends or invest directly in its future progress and development. It is precisely the same with a nation. To the extent that the people can be relied upon to behave in a loyal and responsible manner, the government does not require armies of police and civil servants to keep them in order. But if a nation is disunited, the government cannot be sure that the actions of the people will be in the interests of the nation, and it will have to watch, check, and control the people accordingly. A disunited nation, therefore, has to incur unduly high costs of government. Raymond Frost, The Backward Society. Passage 45.
At the age of 12 years, the human body is at its most vigorous. It has yet to reach its full size and strength, and its owner, his or her, full intelligence. But at this age, the likelihood of death is least. Earlier, we were infants and young children, and consequently more vulnerable. Later, we shall undergo a progressive loss of our vigor and resistance, which, though imperceptible at first, will finally become so steep that we can live no longer, however well we look after ourselves, and however well society and our doctors look after us. This decline in vigor with the passing of time is called aging. It is one of the most unpleasant discoveries which we all make, and we must decline in this way, that if we escape wars, accidents, and diseases, we shall eventually die of old age, and that this happens at a rate which differs little from person to person, so that there are heavy odds in favor of our dying between the ages of 65 and 80. Some of us will die sooner, a few will live longer, on into a ninth or tenth decade. But the chances are against it, and there is a virtual limit on how long we can hope to remain alive, however lucky and robust we are. Normal people tend to forget this process unless and until they are reminded of it. We are so familiar with the fact that man ages
that people have for years assumed that the process of losing vigour with time, of becoming more likely to die the older we get, was something self-evident, like the cooling of a hot kettle or the wearing out of a pair of shoes. They have also assumed that all animals, and probably other organisms such as trees or even the universe itself, must in the nature of things wear out. Most animals, we commonly observe, do in fact age, as we do, if given the chance to live long enough. And mechanical systems like a wound watch, or the sun, do in fact run out of energy in accordance with the second law of thermodynamics. Whether the whole universe does so is a moot point at present. But these are not analogous to what happens when man ages. A rundown watch is still a watch and can be rewound. An old watch, by contrast, becomes so worn and unreliable that it eventually is not worth mending. But a watch could never repair itself. It does not consist of living parts, only of metal, which wears away by friction. We could, at one time, repair ourselves well enough, at least, to overcome all but the most instantly fatal illnesses and accidents. Between 12 and 80 years, we gradually lose this power. An illness which at 12 would knock us over, at 80 can knock us out, and into our grave. If we could stay as vigorous as we are at 12, it would take about 700 years for half of us to die, and another 700 for the survivors to be reduced by half again. Alex Comfort, The Process of Aging. Passage 46.
After millennia of growth so slow that each generation hardly noticed it, the cities are suddenly racing off in every direction. The world population goes up by 2% a year. City population goes up by 4% a year. But in big cities, the rate may be as much as 5 and 6% a year. To give only one example of almost visible acceleration, Athens today grows by 3 dwellings and 100 square meters of road every hour. There is no reason to believe that this pace will slacken. As technology gradually swallows up all forms of work, industrial and agricultural, the rural areas are going to shrink, just as they have shrunk in Britain, and the vast majority of their people will move into the city. In fact, in Britain now, only about 4 or 5% of people live in rural areas and depend upon them. All through the developing world, the vanguard of the rural exodus has reached the urban fringes already, and there they huddle, migrants in the favelas and barrios of Latin America, in shanty towns in Africa, in those horrifying encampments one sees on the outskirts of Calcutta and Bombay. We are heading towards an urban world. This enormous increase will go ahead whatever we do, and we have to remember that the new cities devour space. People now acquire far more goods and things. There is a great density of household goods. They demand more services, such as sewage and drainage. Above all, the car changes everything. Rising incomes and rising populations can make urban car density increase by something like 4 and 5% in a decade. Traffic flows rise to fill whatever scale of highways are provided for them. The car also has a curious ambivalence. It creates and then it destroys mobility. The car tempts people further out and then gives them the appalling problem of getting back. It makes them believe that they can spend Sunday in Brighton, but makes it impossible for them to return before, say, 2 in the morning. People go further and further away to reach open air and countryside, which continuously recedes from them. And just as their working weeks decline and they begin to have more time for leisure, they find they cannot get to the open spaces or the recreation or the beaches, which they now have the time to enjoy. Recently, some studies were made in the behavior of mice when exposed to more than a certain degree of density, frustration, and noise. And the mice just became deranged. I think some sociologists wonder whether it might not be the same for men. This combination of very high density of population, goods and services, and machines, all increasing with almost brutal speed, does account for some really antisocial tendencies in modern urban growth. Barbara Ward, The Menace of Urban Explosion, from The Listener.
来，伴随你走向世界。爱未来，爱未来。